Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Gail Holtz-Borhaft. Holtz-Borhaft is a poet, translator, journalist, broadcaster, and academic. She directed the Mediterranean Initiative at the Institute for European Studies at Cornell University and taught in both Cornell's Department of Comparative Literature and Biological and Environmental Engineering. She has published numerous books about Greece, including Myth, Politics, and Modern Greek Music, Dangerous Voices, Women's Laments, and Greek Literature, and The Fall of Athens. Her most recent book, and what we'll be discussing on today's show, is a beautiful new collection of very personal poetry called Lucky Country, and it was published by Formite Press. And I welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Tish. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. This new book is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
Now, personal poems about your native Australia, poems about your life here in Ithaca. What made you decide to write so much personal poetry after really not pursuing this?
No, I think I was a little nervous of writing about myself. It was too sort of self-revelatory or something. I mean, I always concentrated on Greece and themes that were connected with Greece in some way. And I thought, well, it's now or never, you know, I'm not so young anymore. Oh. And I had written some of these poems a long time ago and never published them. I'd published a couple in magazines, but I held on to them thinking, I don't know whether I want to put this out into the public gaze, but here they are.
Oh, I think it's absolutely beautiful. You know, a lot of people who I've spoken to, poets especially, have told me that they think writing about themselves is too self-indulgent.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we want from poets.
Yes.
I mean, look at how much people love Sylvia Plath's poetry because of that. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, I think it's also maybe a little cultural that the sort of my background as an Australian is slightly not to be so self-revelatory as the American poets are.
Oh, yeah.
I think that has something to do with it.
Yeah, why wouldn't it? Yeah, I hadn't thought about the cultural aspect. Now, I want to ask you, too, are the people that you wrote about, most of them dead or are some of them living? And did you have to censor yourself when you wrote about real people?
Well, no, because my parents have died and I wrote about my great-grandmother, my grandfather. Certainly, I would have censored the poem about my grandfather, I think, had he been still alive because, you know, he's somebody that I was fairly critical of growing up, but poems about my mother I would not have because my mother and I got on like a house on fire. We were very close and had a happy, friendly relationship. So, no, there's no sort of self. And the book ends with three poems dedicated to somebody who was very influential in my writing. That was John Stallworthy. Yes, perhaps I would have censored those had he and his wife still been alive. But both of them have passed on, and I felt free to be open about.
Oh yeah. I can understand that. I didn't really start writing about my mom till after she died.
No.
It frees you up.
Yes, it does.
And it makes you less afraid of your sadness. It seems to me.
Well, yeah. Most poets sort of begin writing poetry out of loss. It seems to me that's the well that you draw on.
Yep, loss and death. And you know, we're really cheerful people, right? Now, so you just told me you started writing these poems years ago. And how did you come up with the collection? Did you continue writing personal poems in the here and now to you know, shape it up?
Yes, I did. I didn't think of it as a collection for a while. And then I sort of looked around and found all these poems that were sitting there, and I thought, maybe there's a connecting thread here. And Lucky Country is a sort of, it's a phrase used about Australia by Australians. You know, we live in the Lucky Country because it was, like America, a land of opportunity, but perhaps even easier because it didn't go through any civil war. Mm. It seemed as if it had had a fortunate, and I think it did have a fortunate existence as a country. And so that sort of provided a connecting theme for some of the poems. And then I've written quite a lot of poems about living in Ithaca, and that was sort of another, partly about nature, but also about my life in Ithaca. And those poems also seem to form a little collection.
Yeah, yeah. Then you reveal a lot about Ithaca. I mean, I obviously know Ithaca. I don't know Australia, but it's they're beautiful, and I love that they're so personal.
Well, I'm glad now that I've written them, that they're out there. But I did have a lot of hesitation about publishing the collection because I thought, is this yet another confessional lot of poetry? And as a genre, I sort of have tried to avoid confessional poetry, but I don't think it's too confessional.
No.
I think I keep a little bit of restraint there somehow.
Yeah, and you include so many people in the landscape.
Yes.
Confessional poetry is when people just get self-indulgent and that's all you see is their sadness, their, you know. Okay, I want to have you read a poem from Lucky Country. This one's called Looking Down on the Lucky Country. To tell us a bit about it.
Well, I remember flying when I was going back to Australia from when I was living in Greece, I think, and I flew back over the country. And what astonished me when I looked down was how empty it was. It was so incredibly empty, and we flew all day over Australia from west to east, and I thought, there's nothing there. And, you know, where do we live, and what is this country? So it's sort of based on actually being in a plane and looking down. But it also has to do with our extraordinary, I think, colonial view of being the occupants of this land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what inspired me. Looking down on the lucky country. We fly all day over desert. No wonder the second comers who tried to cross it died. The colors are faded paint. Rivers snake like sidewinders, then stop. The country gave itself grudgingly to the ones who came and stayed in the Stone Age. They knew only one secret mattered, water, and where to find it. So they sang their way across the land, memorizing each source, bequeathing a map for survival from one generation to the next, stopping to greet members of their totem, passing on. Near the coast, browns turn green, iron roofs wink in the sun. Highways lead to a busy city. If the sea should rise and take a bite out of this coast, it would all be gone, this crust of settlement where we grew up, ignorant of the whole, thinking we knew it.
Wow. And absolutely identified with that one, especially the looking down.
Yes.
From that perspective. Now, you left Australia at a fairly young age. Did you need some distance to be able to craft these poems, or were you writing immediately?
No, I wasn't. And I think unlike Americans, Australians have a feeling that their culture is not there, it's somewhere else. You know, we grew up thinking that everything cultured and interesting was in Europe.
Mm.
We weren't taught any Southeast Asian history or any Australian history much. We were taught British history. History meant British history and colonial history and so on.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I had majored in art history and English literature. And so when I went to Europe, I thought, this is where everything is, you know, and I'm just a nobody from this little place on the other end of the
universe. It's not really a little place, Gail.
Well, it's not so little. But, you know, I grew up when it had a population of 9 million. So this
wow.
vast land had this small population of white people, you know. The native inhabitants weren't sort of a factor. And so to me it was a sense that, you know, I didn't want to be so isolated from everything that seemed to me to represent culture. And I don't think Americans have that sense. I think that they feel quite confident in their own culture as something important and relevant.
But the culture is pretty fragmented, though, you know? I mean, a lot of us have brought cultures from Europe and different parts of the world and tried to mash it together and turn it into a one culture. So
There's something similar.
Yeah, I would say.
You're just a little further down the road than the Australians.
Yeah.
And I think Australia has changed out of all sight since I lived there. But I did grow up feeling that that it was sort of a beautiful landscape in the middle of nowhere.
That's a great way of putting it. That could be your autobiography.
Yeah.
Now, you eventually obviously came to Ithaca, New York, and it was closed about 40 years ago, wasn't it?
It was, and I came in the towards the end of 1980, so I've been here a long time.
Yeah.
This has become very much home for me.
Did it seem alien when you first got here? You know,
so exotic. I remember
exotic.
I remember walking down 72nd Street and going to a deli and seeing a bagel for the first time. I'm thinking I was in a Saul Bellow novel.
Really?
I had no idea about what that culture was like of New York, and especially the Jewish culture of New York, especially, which is something that I was a very great Saul Bellow fan, so I knew all about it in sort of abstract terms, but to actually sit in Fine and Shapiro's and have a chicken soup was something astonishing to me.
And, that is funny.
And very exotic, yes. More exotic in some ways than going to London, for example, which seemed quite familiar to me. But America had this flavor that was very much from movies, and I knew it from movies and books.
Yeah, I think that probably is one of the things that people rely on.
Yes,
to think of. Especially New York.
Yeah, especially New York. Yeah. I mean, Ithaca was just the most beautiful landscape and quite different from that experience. But even so, it was strange to me. There were a lot of things that were strange. And the landscape was all upside down and back to front.
I can feel that. I can sense that.
Yeah.
I want you to have read another from Lucky Country. This one is called On the Bridge to Tremaine Gorge.
Tremaine Gorge, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this is a poem dedicated to my husband, who I came to Ithaca because of, but who is also Australian. And his field of expertise is fluid mechanics. He studies turbulence and fluids. So
wow.
When we are out walking or looking at the clouds or something, he talks about the landscape in a rather different way than I do. So here we are standing on the bridge at Tremaine Gorge. We stand on the bridge watching the water. Leaves land on the surface, turn this way and that, distracted from the flow into eddies, changing direction, the smallest joining a swirl of bubbles in a vortex. I see it as a pattern that pleases the eye. You see it obeying Lagrange's equations. In nature, you've taught me, nothing is truly random. The laminar flow devolves into turbulence, order into disorder, without apparent pattern. And yet a child makes order of a cloud, scalloping its edges into arched puffs. And water, in its wildest flow, braids itself like a woman's hair. The almost infinite degrees of freedom in turbulent motion should end in chaos. But order creeps in, an order the eye finds in disorder.
Wow. Do you think as a poet you're trying to regain some kind of or take hold of some kind of order in your life?
I wouldn't say so much in my life, because I suppose for the last 40 years I've had a fairly orderly life compared with my sort of youth in Europe and traveling around. But I do think that I like pattern and order. I like traditional cultures for that reason. I fell in love with Greece because there wasn't a village that you went to that didn't have its own distinctive music and dance. And that sort of, I find that very rich, that sort of order. And I find it in nature too. I like patterns and order in nature. Even if it looks chaotic, you always find something that speaks to you in a sort of way that's not exactly orderly, but...
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gail Holtz-Warhoff. We're talking about her new collection of poetry called Lucky Country. This is one of her more personal books. You've written extensively about Greece. We all know that, and I've had you on talking about it. Where did this interest come from?
Well, the cheapest way to get from Australia to Europe was on a Greek ship that had come out with Greek immigrants on it.
Ah.
And so it would have gone back empty had they not sold off tickets to students and people who had very little money. And so for a very small amount, I was able to go to Greece thinking that I was going to go on to Italy and Paris and, you know, the more sort of conventional destinations. I was, of course, wanted to see Greece, but I thought, you know, I'll see a few things and go on. And then I fell in love, and I fell in love and have remained in love with Greece ever since. And people say, oh, was it ancient Greece? No, I say. And was it the islands? Well, yes and no, but really, I fell in love with Athens, and I fell in love with the sort of culture of Greece that is so warm and expressive.
And so rich.
And rich, yeah.
Yeah, I can understand falling in love with a culture.
Yeah.
But most people don't delve into it the way you have. It's amazing.
I knew not a word of modern Greek, and I, you know, in a way, I've sort of devoted my life to trying to become Greek. If in some way, I have a sort of double life. I have my Ithaca life, and I have my Greek life, where I spend most of my working time translating or writing about it. Except these poems, which are the exception to the rule.
Yeah, and it's been a pleasure to get to know you through these poems, I must admit.
Thank you.
Let's have you read another from Lucky Country. This one is called Guardians. And this one seems very personal, too.
Yes, and it's a rather strange poem. It's about how people grow together, who are, you know, together as a couple for a long, long time, and how you think you know each other very well, and you build up a picture of each other, and it's perhaps not quite as you imagine.
Mm.
Guardians. We're guardians of each other's memories. Your family quarrels loud enough to scare neighbors a block away. Your Scottish housekeeper killed crossing the road to post a letter are as much my memories as yours. You remember me before we met on a horse's back watching clouds, my father singing his music hall songs. We've grown like that double tree we saw in the woods, two trunks, branches inseparable. But on a hot afternoon in Florida, fan lazing overhead, you surprise me. You've always liked those slow revolving Chinese fans, you say. What fans? I ask. What else do you remember for me? You carried a knife before you met me. I only know the one I open letters with. Whose memories are they now? They grow toward each other until I'm left with your Scottish housekeeper. You have my slow fans and a lost knife.
I love it. And were you actually bringing back memories to write that?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, and one talks with one's partner or one's friend, whoever it is that one spends a lot of time together with, about the past. And you talk about your childhood and childhood memories and things, something go in one ear, I think, and out the other, and other things stay with you and begin to become your memories. And then I'm not quite sure how faithful we are to each other's memories.
I would suspect that we're not too faithful.
I think we choose what we want to believe, to sort of retain of those memories.
Yeah.
And of course, we hear them related. We don't see them. We don't live them. So they remain a little bit abstract to us, I think.
Yeah, and maybe prettier in some cases.
Yes, yes.
Now, have you always had poetry cascading through your life, or was this something you picked up in Greece when you started studying the culture? Tell us.
It's a very interesting thing that my mother read me a lot of poetry. She had taught English literature, and so when I was quite a small child, my mother always read me poetry, and I loved it, and I would always ask for more. And, you know, I wrote some very bad little poems here and there, but I never thought that I could write good poetry, so I was sort of hesitant to ever show it to anyone else. And it was really when I began translating Greek poetry, especially the poetry of a poet that I love called Nikos Kavadias, not so well known, but I translated all his poems over a period of 5 years. You know, I'd go back and I'd talk to his sister. He'd already passed on, but his sister was alive. And I just loved him as a poet. And at that stage, John Stallworthy was teaching English teaching poetry here at Cornell still. And I met him socially. We started talking about poetry and Greece and so on. And he asked to see the translations. And he fell for Kavadias in a big way. He loved him too. And he said, "And where are your poems?" And I said, "But I don't write poems." "Oh," he said, "anybody who translates like that probably writes poems, I think. Now, why don't you show me a poem?" So I very hesitantly showed him a poem, and he really encouraged me to keep writing. And I used to send everything I wrote to him, and it would come back with a slight, tiny little pencil marks here and there, very, you know, very polite little suggestions. And I think had it not been for John, I wouldn't be a poet. I mean, I wouldn't think of myself as a poet, because he gave me that sort of confidence to think that what I wrote might be worth reading by somebody else.
God, that's amazing to me that you had the guts to actually show him.
Well,
most people are showing it to their friends, and the friends go, "Oh, this is unbelievable." But showing a professional poet your work is brave.
Well, yes, and I didn't show him much, but you know, but having shown him my translations, I was sort of already into a sort of literary relationship I felt with him, and he would. Yes, I suppose it was daring to show them to him, but...
Oh, I'm glad you did. It encouraged you to keep on moving toward that toward that voice.
I still like to... He's very sadly, I miss him. He died a couple of years ago, but I still have a couple of poets, friends, who I trust to tell me if a poem is worthy before I sort of send it out into the world. I don't know whether I'll ever get beyond that, get to a stage where I feel without... showing it to anybody that this is it,
Ah, yeah. I've talked to other poets, and I think a lot of people feel that way.
Yeah.
They want to see if the world can identify what you're saying, right?
I think that's particularly applicable to personal poetry when we're writing about our own experiences, because we have so much unstated there, and people will say to me, "Well, you haven't explained why this," or it's mostly clarification, I think.
Well, also secrets that people have, you know, they're ashamed or afraid, or they think they're going to bore you.
Yes, that's awesome.
Because I hadn't heard that much about your life in Australia, so this book was a revelation to me because of that,
Well, I'm glad I did write about it in the end. I went back to Australia last year for the first time in 12 years, and I didn't feel I wanted to go back there to live, but I did... find some old friends and sort of feel that nice sense that there were still some people I really wanted to spend some time with there. People I thought, you know, would have forgotten me and so on, but it was very nice to find that there were a few friends still there.
Oh, that's, I think it's important to be able to connect with your past. I want you to read a final poem from from your book, The Body Forgets.
Yes. This is a poem about my youth, and it's sort of based a little bit on that beautiful poem by Gavafi, a poem that a lot of people do know, I think, called Thimisu Soma, which means remember body. So I'm going the other way. The body forgets. The mind forgets. We worry about a name not retrieved in time or why we went into a room, but the body's guilty too. The smell of Dior lipstick used to transport me straight to the Cairo Museum, its dusty shelves crowded with poorly sorted relics, and a hand that touched mine and whispered, 8 o'clock, D-deck. Decades later, one sniff was enough. Now, in the cosmetics department, I lift a lipstick to my nose and nothing happens. My mind remembers. My body fails to contract as it did for so long, triggering a spasm of pure desire. I don't want his name. It can sink into the Suez Canal with the ship where my parents drank cocktails and he waited on the dark deck and kissed the scarlet from my lips. Now I'm left with the brand of a lipstick I bought that day. The body's forgotten what it felt like, that rush of blood through the veins.
That, you know, and it's a vibrant poem, but it's also very sad in many ways.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful.
It's something about that first sort of excitement of the first sensuous life you have when you're... I was 19, I think, 18, 19.
Uh-huh.
I went for the first time to Europe with my parents, and in those days the Suez Canal was open, so ships went through the Suez Canal, and you got off, if you wished to, at one end of the canal and went on a little bus ride to the pyramids and so on, and the Cairo Museum, and then you rejoined the boat at Port Said at the other end of the canal, it having taken the entire day to pass through the canal.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a memory from another age, and, you know, my parents were of another age. They were older parents, but they had been there before and didn't want to do the trip, so I did it alone. But I'd had this shipboard romance, you know.
Well, and then you explain it.
I can't remember much about this except that whenever I smelt this particular lipstick, I would have this sort of absolutely faultless bodily memory, which has disappeared.
That is interesting, isn't it? That's why it probably took you a while to get over it in some ways.
Yes. I mean, you wonder whether, you know, that's one of the things that you can't retrieve. You know, you can't retrieve that sort of memory.
Yeah.
And Cavafy wrote so many of his poems about an afternoon, a meeting in a cafe, the sight of some young man he'd seen drinking coffee somewhere. You know, it was always these intense bodily memories. And he's obviously writing as an elderly poet or an older poet saying, remember, don't forget those things. They're the most important things.
Yeah.
Because they were, I think, the inspiration for all his poetry.
Oh, yeah. And those moments in life are poetry.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
To tell us about this collection, was it a cathartic experience? Was it painful? Do you have longings for the past? How did you react to it?
I don't think it was painful. I don't think so. The poems were, as I say, written over quite a long period. I mean, I would say that the earliest poems that were written 20 years ago and some 2 years ago and so on. But they all were poems that were nostalgic. I had a very happy childhood. I had, you know, very loving parents and I would say a very happy childhood. And a childhood which was rural, even though we were on the outskirts of Melbourne. In those days, that was rural. And animals and a little farm and a sort of ideal childhood. It was when I became an adolescent and had to travel to go to school in Melbourne and became conscious of, I think, the rather limited and chauvinistic culture of Australia, that I began to not be so happy in Australia, that I didn't like it so much. As a child, I was not interested in those aspects of the culture. I was interested in the bush and the animals and my family.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in literature, I was always completely lost in some book. In fact, you could operate on me, I think, and if the book was good enough that I was reading, I wouldn't even notice.
Oh, don't dare anybody to try that. We are almost out of time, Gail. This has been a pleasure talking to you about this. To tell us what's coming up next, do you have any books in the...
I'm halfway through on Greek island music, and it's rather odd. Greeks call a certain style of music island music, and they don't mean all the Greek islands. They mean really the Cyclades and the Eastern Aegean. And so that music is very beautiful, and the lyrics, which I didn't sort of pay much attention to when I first went to Greece, are extraordinarily sad, most of them, because so many of the young men who went to sea were drowned or else they were forced to emigrate because these islands were so poor. And so for their mothers, they were more or less dead anyway. The mothers couldn't read or write and so on. And I began to find them fascinating, these songs about the sea, which tourists think of as such a beautiful thing, and these beautiful, picturesque Greek islands. The more I read these lyrics, the more I became conscious of the sadness of this.
That's going to be a beautiful book.
I hope so.
It sounds like it. Anyway, people can get in touch with you if they want to right now.
Yes. I mean, I have a website now, gailholst-warhaft.com. And also, I have a Cornell email, glh3@cornell.edu. So that's possible. And I just wanted to say before I finish that you and I talk a lot about publishing and poetry. And I must say I was so grateful to the publisher Fomite for publishing this collection. They are the most idealistic and wonderful people to work with. It was such a pleasure working with them.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, Gail Holst-Werhoff, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to talk about Lucky Country. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tish. A pleasure to talk to you too.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.